Well, we now turn to this final session of the conference, and the idea here is twofold. One, to allow our keynote speakers to engage one another or get their last licks in on whatever they'd like to say. And two, to give you opportunity to ask questions, especially questions that bring together some of these things we've been reflecting on. So that's the goal. We'll go until 4:15 or shortly thereafter, and then we'll break, and then we'll come back at 4:30 for evening prayer. So I'll get the ball rolling here. I have a question that I'd like each of you to consider. Instead of invoking the blessed Jamie Smith, I'm invoking the blessed late John Webster, who in his book on holiness talks about the Christian life and Christian formation in a twofold sense, one of mortification and vivification. And it's a beautiful way of capturing, really, essentially, the Christian life. It strikes me that we're faced at this time in the church's life with a corporate challenge of asking, to what shall we die so that we may live into the condition, the situation that we are in now? Or as Julia Marie put it, in order to become a disciple, there are habits you have to unlearn. So my question to you would be, from your perspective, each one of you, and I'd like each one of you to take a turn at this, what one thing or one aspect would you see of that which we might need to die to in the church, either corporately or perhaps individually, in our context today, in order to live more fully and more faithfully in ways that we're recognizing we need to in order to form Christian disciples? And I will give anybody who wants the opportunity to start. So, those mics are all live. Whoever wants to start can start.
I'll begin simply by saying I think one of the themes that's come up in one or two ways has been that if spiritual formation is going to mean something, it's going to have something to do with denial. And by denial, here I'm referring to the denial of not just the self, but it might be the denial of a group. It might be that there are practices, places, there might be forms of entertainment. That's usually the most obvious. It's not as common, I notice, when we talk about spiritual formation and we talk about the things that we need to add and do, and we need to do this differently and put this together differently. I think there's a value to be willing and frankly, once we get out of a conference like this, courageous enough to stay with, well, there's going to have to be a number of things that we don't do anymore or that we deny that should be done, and stand on some of these things. And a certain amount of the ascetic life, while it just wasn't surrounded around denial, but a certain amount of self-deprivation was regarded as a healthy thing. It was regarded as a good place to begin. And in our culture, one hears just the opposite. It's more you can add will be to the better. And that strikes me as a counterintuitive thing to do and to say and think, and yet needs to be done and said.
Yeah, I'm going to say that one of the chief things is that we have to die to our Americanism. And I mean by that a number of things. I think there's a whole lot bound up in that, perhaps more than we realize. One layer of it is a kind of patriotism that idolizes the nation. Another is a more subtle kind of nationalism that puts our hopes for the future of God's kingdom, for the future, the McIntyre quote had it, future of civility and sanity. And our hopes for that are placed on the perpetuation of the American system. I think that's bound up with our instinct toward autonomy and our resistance to any kind of structures of authority and obedience. We're no more American than we rebel against authority. It's bound up in my mind with the whole denominational system. Denominational Christianity, I've concluded, is not a disestablishment of the church, but it is the established church in a pluralistic system. And it's bound up with a particular vision of America. And if we're going to have a unified church, we have to die to that. I don't say that, the qualification is, I don't say that any out of any hatred or hostility toward our country or any desire to denigrate it. But it's America has played a very distorting role in the history of American Christianity, and we need to overcome that.
So maybe I'll go a little more practical, or maybe just a little more specific, working out of some of that. You know, like, to go first, you could have just said, well, you have to die to self, and then you're done, right? Like, good biblical answer. I think maybe even broadening out, dying to just some of our Western patterns. And I'm just going to focus on one thing in particular because it's been occupying my mind lately. So I noticed a couple years ago, maybe three, that my now nearly 15-year-old son loved technology. And we didn't have a lot of it in the house, but and they had limited screen time as kids. You know, they could only watch their videos for up to, I mean, anything with a screen for an hour a day. That was it. But I noticed my soon-to-be 15-year-old liked technology, and now I realize he loves it. So I started looking into what technology does to you. Well, it kills you is functionally what it does. But actually, the thing that I'm thinking of right this minute is it takes you further and further into an individualistic existence. You don't even have real friends anymore. You don't have real conversations with, you know, living, breathing human beings. And so I think, you know, to maybe be just a little more practical, but to an extension out from this Americans, I think, is we kind of need to die to these things that the world is telling us are essential for us, when in fact they're not essential. We know they're not essential, but we can't help ourselves, perhaps. And I say this as someone with no, that I can discern in my life so far, no addictive tendencies at all, nor towards technology. But I think that's just an important thing to think about. Like, this Americanism, this Westernism is bringing stuff into our life that's making us just more disconnected from actual community. And if that's the crucible of formation, then there's just no way we're going to be formed in a community. We're going to be malformed and deformed is the only way we'll be formed.
My comments will sound a bit like Peter's, and I was planning to say this before he did, but I'll continue anyhow. I would say the two things, there are really two things, and they are related, but the first would be the nationalistic allegiance and liturgy that we as a church, as churches participate in, as we allow and sometimes encourage our children to participate in. Little context. I come from church traditions that generally many people will frown on regular liturgical events in a way that, if we celebrated Eucharist every week, we would get tired of it. It would seem like rote. And to those same people, I want to say, well, what do you allow your children to do every morning when they go to school? They're saying the Pledge of Allegiance 180 days a year for 13 years. There's a formation going on. There's a liturgy that they're participating in every day, and yet these same people don't want to say the Apostles' Creed on Sunday morning. It goes back to my point yesterday about stories, and this, when we leave the creed behind, the vacuum has to be filled. Related to that, and to pick again on Peter's point, is the whole notion of freedom that has its roots in the Enlightenment and that has come to expression in such detrimental ways, as we heard in our homily from Amy yesterday morning. It's part of that worldview, part of those practices, as we heard this morning, they have to be unlearned to be learned, new things to be learned. And that's, both of those are huge, huge issues and difficult things to struggle with.
I think I would say probably dying to expectations and entitlements and the idea of it wasn't meant to be this way, or I'm in a first world country, I shouldn't have to deal with this, or my life isn't playing out the way that I thought that it would. If I bought into the I can be anything, I can do anything, even as a woman, you know, go and get your PhD and you can have it all. And that plays a picture and a movie in your mind of what life should be. And even if it's a distorted view, the death of a dream is still grief. And so having to process the grief of the adults and cast the dreams different for the youth and in the true story of what to expect from life, what to value, who am I and who are you, and what is my obligation to you as my neighbor, friend or enemy, but still neighbor, and realistically setting, not in a pessimistic way, but a life of service and a simplicity and contentment and dying to self and emptying is something that can be naturally, you know, fostered without the, you know, we used to say it's easier to train than retrain, and don't let your 5-pound puppy do something you don't want your 100-pound dog doing. When they're little, I can form them. And so set the expectations, you know, well. And the entitlements, the glory doesn't go to us. And when you're in that screen time and I'm getting sucked more into the vortex of, you know, no man's land, then it's depersonalizing. And for youth who think that they have entitlement to my stuff, my time, who are you to tell me? Then it's a hard shock to the identity to have to give that up.
If we're really so humble about ourselves, the American churches are going to need to learn from churches in other countries. That has come up perhaps a little bit here, but not too much. And there's a lot of distance to go on that. But the very concept of the way in which, in my case, I'm most familiar with China, and generalizations are always very hazardous, but here we go. The Chinese Christian emphasis on well-being, health, and satisfaction is not something that operates in the same way here. We tend to place high emphases on these things. Chinese Christians as a whole, they care about those things, but we've discussed martyrdom a couple times here, more than a couple times in our panel. In a number of places in the world, it's not nearly so theoretical. There, and by martyr, it may not mean, and usually doesn't mean, to the death. What it normally means, and it's true in the Roman Empire as well, is that you lost a lot of property, or you lost a lot of money, or you were not merely inconvenienced. You were kept in some kind of captivity for a while. Maybe a very valuable thing of this theme of dying to self might have to do with learning how other Christians think about well-being and yet the need, ever-present need, to suffer for Christ. I confess, when I think about suffering for Christ, there are certain ways that I would elect and choose to do that, and then there's ways I don't want to do it. One of the blessings about getting older is you have fewer choices about that, and so I think maybe that's a God-given thing. Doesn't sound like it, perhaps, but I think it is. But I would like to see incorporated more often in our own conferences and discussions about formation, is the formation of other Christian cultures and where this whole concept of how one thrives or flourishes and without cynicism can be something that we start to learn again.
I want to give time for questions, but go ahead, Pierre.
Yeah. Could I ask a question to a fellow panelist?
Sure.
As Rod Dreher's alter ego at the conference, I was take personal affront at Greg's attack on myself. No, I wanted to push a little bit on the question of the Benedict option as a parachurch model. I think that Rod Dreher would admit that his concept of what the hashtag Ben-op means in practice is still in development. He's got some parameters, and he's written a good bit about it, and somewhat a theoretical level. When he describes individual cases, specific cases where he thinks that something like his Benedict option is being carried out, he's usually talking about a community of believers that is attached to a local church. He has written about visiting a monastery or visiting a Catholic community in Italy near a monastery, connected to a monastery, connected to a local church parish, but it was a group within that parish that determined that they wanted to they weren't excluding other members of the parish, but they wanted to devote themselves to a more serious form of Christian community and a more serious form of Christian living. And they've done that together, open to other members of the parish coming in. So that's kind of a standard example that he gives, where it's attached to a local parish. And I'm not sure that parachurch is exactly the right way to describe what he's getting at.
I don't see Amy in here. She didn't like the word parachurch either. There you are. Sorry, Amy. You were hiding. Because you knew I was going to talk about you. So, this would be a really interesting question. I mean, it is an interesting one if we had more time to talk about and if there was enough collective interest. Some of the monks that I'm friends with would probably say, no, monasticism is parachurch. Like, literally, this monastic church is not a parish. You know, it's a Roman Catholic chapel and church, but it's not a parish church. Now, these days, monasteries do a lot of parish things. They marry, they bury, they baptize, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not parish churches with the same responsibilities and obligations. And oftentimes, they're not even under the local ordinary. So in that sense, the question could be just backed up some to be a more fundamental question about monasticism and how they have self-identified historically. But maybe just to bring it a little closer to Anglican things, if you know the work of Martin Thornton, who I mentioned briefly, you'll know that Thornton's matrix of prayer, communion, and asceticism is for the remnant, his remnant theology. So he recognizes, like, 10% of my congregation wants this, cares about this, and will show up to do it. I'm just making up that number. I don't know what he names. But 90% aren't. And he developed a theology around that of the remnant, and therefore you do these ascetical things and these regular offices and everything primarily for the remnant. My hesitation, and I'm not speaking about the Benedict option here at all, and a friend of mine calls it the Benedict imperative, is just that I would not want to see anything gain traction that implied that there's the 30, 60, 100-fold Christians, you know, that kind of goes back to the early. I mean, that's a common way to exegete that passage in the early church was the 100-fold are the monks, the 60-fold are the widows, and the 30-fold are all the other schleps out there having children. So I have, I'm a bit allergic to those things, and I hear that. I mean, I'm looking forward to when Jared publishes the book, so we can kind of have the official word, if you will. But at the same time, that's kind of my concern, and maybe why I'm thinking of it as parachurch is because a lot of my monastic friends would call it that, and I think that's what they even mean by the little church within the church. But you know, these are live questions, so. But I'm happy to offend you anytime.
I'm going to exercise my exercise my role here and open the floor to any questions. So please find your way to the microphone and have at it.
I'm not quite sure how to ask the question, but I want to get back to Joel's original question about dying to self. And I believe it was Dr. Greg Peters' response about technology. I don't know that we're ever going to be able to not use technology by dying to it. And the question came into my mind about human agency and divine agency, and how do we mold our children to appropriately use these technologies that we seem to be enslaved to?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think that the reality is the day has passed. We're dependent on them now. There's no way to go back. I do think it's your attitude towards them is still very important. You know, how we use them, maybe even more importantly, how our children, I would even go so far as to say parishioners and others see us use that, I think is really important. I mean, trained as a medievalist, I often think like, well, what's the iPhone of the Middle Ages? I mean, there isn't one. I mean, kids had distractions, I'm sure, but the distractions were probably
a stick
you know? And so I do think, yes, you're right. I'm not a Luddite, but I do only have a 4S iPhone. So my first and only one. You know, yeah.
Whoa. Do
you have a phone?
Mike,
where's your phone?
Oh, damn it.
No cell service in Waco.
On this?
We're Virtus.
It's the love and attraction of novelty that drives technology, I think, to its worst aspects. And that is, you never have enough. You're always got to have the new model, and it could be a toaster, you know, but whatever. I think I just dated myself. But anyways, that's the hardest thing for not just young people, but adults as well, is the gravitation that you will not be in step with culture or being able to take advantage of the benefits or blessings of your culture unless you have, I don't know, what's the new thing?
Just 6 or something.
Okay, whatever.
Right here.
Chill, chill. Yeah.
Okay, that.
Is this on? I can't tell. I think about Augustine's recounting of his stealing of the pears, and he refers to it as a kind of, he tries to figure out what it was his motivation, what was he seeking after, and he refers to that act as a dim shadow of omnipotence, I think, or a dim likeness of omnipotence. I actually think that's what the technology kind of promises, is this almost quasi divine capability. We can know all things, we can be everywhere simultaneously. That sort of thing. So, yeah.
Julie Marie.
Go ahead, Julie Marie.
I think with the technology, it's also the slippery slope of lack of reflection on the micro habits that it causes for us. I didn't have a smartphone 5 years ago. I couldn't check email on my phone. There wasn't a temptation to check email on my phone at my bedside at night and then get hijacked by a response to something that should have waited till morning and thereby disrupt conversation, you know, with my spouse and disrupt my sleep. I didn't, you know, intentionally choose to have a device be part of my hand so that when I'm on vacation and it's not in my pocket, I feel like I've lost a limb. It happened slowly over time because I used to check email, you know, dial up. You had to. I mean, my first master's and most of my PhD didn't even have email. You know, you had limited time. You had to call in. You cared about your modem rate. And so it was a slippery slope, and I didn't think about it. And so texting, oh, I'm just getting back to this person. I don't want to be rude to them. But I wasn't thinking that I'm being rude to the person sitting next to me. So a couple years ago, it was after checking email before bed, you know, at whatever o'clock that I shouldn't have and getting hijacked by something that could have waited till morning and recognizing I need to have some different patterns and habits of what I'm doing with this thing. And that was nothing intentional on my part, but if I had let it go. And that's some of the seductive into it. It's not that there's lack of free agency on my part. Nobody forced me to check email 10 times a day. But I wasn't intentionally setting boundaries on something that I allowed to creep in to my entitlement and what I should be able to do. And that's where that space to kind of think on our rhythms and habits and what is it telling me and the world and my kids.
I don't think I've heard in the last 2 days much discussion of what we can do or should do when our best efforts toward Christian formation don't seem to work. We all know of people in our parishes who have participated in the liturgies for decades, have been in a Christian community, have done everything that we have done as a congregation or in our homes, children who have been disciplined, who have been trained, who have been taught to pray and taught to read the Bible. Even people who practice Dallas Willard's and Richard Foster's disciplines, the form is there, but there doesn't seem to be any formation. They don't seem to develop and show the gifts and the fruits of the Spirit. And I'm wondering, how do we respond to that?
Two thoughts occur to me. One would be, I'm not sure that we know what our ministries are doing. We don't know what kind of seeds that we're planting. We don't know what's germinating. And we don't know what might be sprouting and growing later. The other point is the obvious one that your last comment gets to the thrust of it, which is that what we're looking for, we talk about habits and practices, but we have the can fall into the danger of making it more mechanistic than it in fact is, and that if you have the proper inputs, you can have the proper outputs. But it is a work of the Spirit. It's a work of grace. And so it's, you know, continue to minister in faith that God is going to give a harvest and pray for the Spirit to enliven it.
Thank you. It's been a joy to really sit at the feet of everyone here. I've especially appreciated all of the folks that have talked about being subversive agents in our culture that often idolizes busyness and all these things that we've been talking about. But as I'm sitting reflecting, it's hard not to leave today, to walk away thinking that we ought to be, by and large, horrified of the world around us, just terrified of culture as a whole. Is there a place in formation, in our Christian formation? And I'm thinking also about parenting and discipling youth and children. Is there a place to recognize the good in our cultural milieu, to seek the welfare of the city, as Jeremiah would say? Or in your opinion, has that ship sailed?
Well, no, the ship has not sailed, because to say so would to betray a really bad theology of creation and of God's providence. I imagine, and I can only imagine it, I imagine people of every time and place have felt like the world was, certainly in the last days, I mean, there it is in Thessalonians, and the medieval literature around the year 1000 is so morbid. Like they were all going to die in a screaming ball of fire. And they didn't, which was probably surprising to them the day after that. So I think we can look for good. I mean, but this goes back to finding the good and creating goods to justify things are different. And I'll be the first to say I have a hard time sometimes of finding the good. I can justify things a lot more easily, but trying to find that which is good, which and there I'm thinking more of platonically almost, just like the ideal of the good, is hard and maybe getting harder to do. But I do think if all we were going to do is encourage parishioners, either as ministers in the church or just leaders in the church, if we're going to encourage them to look away from the world because there's nothing out there worth your time, I mean, you've become a sect at some point. This is more about helping them to, I don't know where this phrase comes from, but exegeting the culture. Someone used that with me once, so now I've used it again. So, whatever that means, I think we need to do that, but we also have to hold in tension with the robust theology of creation. Augustine could be a great person to help us with that, I think.
If I could add, the last thing I would want anyone to leave with is a sense of fear. And I probably was the fear-monger as much as anybody. Didn't mean to be. Because I think if we're in an age of upheaval, which I think is true, what I see is opportunity, God upsetting things that need to be upset. God is still king and judge of his world, and if things are being shaken down, it's so that things that can't be shaken will stand. So I don't, fear is exactly the wrong response. I think fear of God, being full of the Spirit with zeal for facing whatever challenges we face. I think that's the attitude I would encourage rather than fear. And as far as I could spend a lot of time talking about the things that I think are redeemable, even the kinds of things I was talking about last evening. What do you the apocalyptic clues that we have? That's a clue to something. It may be I don't understand the obsession with zombies. And my kids have tried to explain it to me. I don't understand the obsession with zombies. But there's a clue there somewhere to some kind of cultural feeling that I think we need to attend to. I'm not going to watch The Walking Dead. I'm not going to spend my time doing that. But knowing that there are things that I would spend my time watching that I think are challenging, and so I think there's a lot that's in our contemporary culture that's not just clues to things that are kind of taking the temperature of our culture, but things that are actually edifying.
And remembering that God is good and does good, and there's hope there, and there's joy and good in seeing a life transformed and seeing a neighborhood come back alive and seeing people start to minister to each other. And, I mean, all good is God's good, and every good gift is from above, and there's beauty. And I'm just not going to find it ultimately in the world's answer to my heart's questions. I mean, my heart's questions are there because I'm made in the image of God, and those will be satisfied ultimately in the whole narrative. And so you can be hopeful and peaceful in the midst of just falling around you because you know how the story ends. And so, like Jeremiah and watching things fall to ruin, that the joy comes in the morning. I mean, that you can be peaceful and hopeful in the midst of that.
I think we're going to have, I'm sorry, Rosalie, Phil beat you to it, and it's going to have to be our last question.
Yeah, thank you. I have to say, I'm incredibly, intensely jealous that Dan just got to teach a course, a whole class on Augustine's City of God. I'm just intensely jealous that you got to do that. I wish I could do that.
But
I'm starting out with that confession because I do think that the City of God is a great example, a classic example of doing what Peter just referred to, which is studying culture for the clues regarding the human condition, regarding the theology of creation and all sorts, all manifold of things that are delightful and also really scary at the same time. So I really appreciate those two observations right there. And then the question that comes up in my mind as I'm thinking about that is, are we doing an adequate job both in theological education at, say, the seminary level and also in lay catechesis at the local parish level in training disciples of Jesus Christ to be adequate discerners of these clues? And I don't mean, I worded that in a very judgmental way. What I would then want to hear, if any of the panelists could share, would be what are some, where is that happening, either in theological education, where most of you are ensconced during your professional lives, but what about the local parish where you do see a heightened critical self-awareness being nurtured and sustained in the life of discipleship so that we can be better discerners of the clues?
I can start by just a few things. The primary theme of Augustine's City of God, all 22 books, is providence. That's what drives almost every book, even though he's reconstructing in the first 10 books the ways in which Christians and non-Christians should react to disasters. And the way in which we react to disasters says a lot about us. And so he begins by quickly reviewing some of the most recent disasters and reminding us how many there really have been over the hundreds and hundreds of years. And please get your mind into a right perspective, please. He starts like that. It's just ever so slightly uppity and just a little annoying. But he's asking one to get one's head into a position of don't think the disasters that are happening are just so unique and are so horrific to your age in such a way that we now just can't go forth from here. And we pray for God's help and we just sure hope it happens. So the point of him writing it starts initially with a Christian perspective on when things go horribly wrong. And not just where is God. So he's not really out just to talk about a theodicy, but more about, and then he starts out with book 11 and onward and really on to 22. And he begins to do what was very popular in the early and middle 5th century, and that is give a history of the world. It's a long story, but that just turned into a real popular literature. As you start with, and you always started with Genesis 1, and then you wrote up into your present time of wherever you were in the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire, and you said, that's the world. Here we are. And Augustine does something like this, but a little more circumspectly. And he begins by reemphasizing something that has already come up, and that is the absolute necessity of the goodness of creation, and that that's not going to change. It does not matter how many disasters happen. And the next thing he mentions, with the fall, and then a number of the terrible things that has happened, what he wants to do continuously is put our present experiences, and especially the bad ones, into a divine perspective. So how much does God see or understand or empathizes with us, or how deep does God's depth go with us? And so his answers are not meant to titillate the reader, but they are meant to put life into a category of a truly, truly providential way of understanding God is going to be a very confident perspective about your life, even when the disasters happen. And he says, and they will happen. The idea of being a Christian isn't to keep running from each disaster as it occurs. No, I don't want my plane to go down in the Pacific tomorrow night. It would not be my idea. But I also trust God because I hate flying. I hate flying. But I'll get on the plane and I will not go and usually do what I do and introduce myself to the pilot and ask about his or her credentials. That went out a few years ago when they put the armored doors on. But I will talk to the stewardess at least for a few moments and see if she knows what she's doing. But I utterly will hold to the God of history is also the God of time and eternity, and that includes my history.
Could I just say one quick thing?
Okay, this is going to have to be the last comment. Yeah.
In answer to your question, I would highly recommend the work of Ken Myers, if you don't know it, and the Mars Hill Audio Magazine. If you're looking for sophisticated Christian commentary on contemporary culture, nobody does it better than Ken Myers.
What's the name of it?
Let us thank our speakers.
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.